We welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. We have one case on the docket that has oral argument, and that is, we'll start at 1:30, and we have several other cases that will be decided, submitted today without oral argument. Before we begin, I wanted to introduce the panel members. To my right is Justice Elizabeth Kerr. To my left is Justice Mark Pittman, and I'm Justice Bonnie Sutterth. Will the clerk please call the case?
The court will now call in the interest of S.R. A. Child. May it please the court, Mr. Jeff Kaser will argue for the appellate, M.S. Mr. Thomas Michelle will argue for the appellate, R.R.
You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. I do want to say one thing. This morning at about 11:40, Mr. Michelle filed some sort of a notice on a alleged jurisdictional issue. I did not have time. Apparently, he's claiming somehow that the trial court has issued a final order thereby. I'm not sure what the claim is or why it is relevant now. The trial court has not issued a final order with respect to a motion to modify that was filed subsequent to the appeal. And I did give to the clerk, I had to scramble and got some evidence real quick to show that all that was being done is temporary orders in the court below. I know this because I'm trial counsel in the court below. So to that extent, I don't think that what he has filed has any relevance to today's proceeding. As the court knows from the briefs, this is an appeal from the 325th Judicial District Court in a family law case. The mother appeals the judgment of the court, which granted the father sole managing conservatorship over a child, a 10-year-old child, and gave her a sole possessory conservatorship. The case was based on a modification of an order, and the case has a long procedural history, which we set out in our brief, which I'm sure all of the justices have read. The case was originally filed in 2012, was tried in June of 2015. At the trial, the case, before the trial, the case was postured in that my client, the mother, had, and I was not trial counsel at that time below, but my client, the mother, had joint managing conservatorship of the child with the father. She was the, what we call the primary joint managing conservator. She filed a motion to do some additional things to modify the order. The father then filed a counter petition requesting that the parties be named as joint managing conservators, but that he had the primary right of possession. And he, at the time of trial, took the position that the mother should be granted an expanded standard of visitation. Following a two-day trial and an interview with the child, the trial court removed my client as a joint managing conservator, made the father the sole managing conservator, and awarded my client, the mother, a less than standard possession order. We believe that the court abused its discretion in appointing the father as the sole managing conservator of the child and in awarding the mother a less than standard possession schedule of the child when, in fact, there was no notice of the relief sought. We have cited in our brief two cases which we believe are right on point. One case is the ABH case decided by this court. I believe in 2008-2009. It is almost exactly on point. In that case, the pleadings of the father asked for a joint managing conservator with him asking for the primary right of possession. The court modified by naming the father as the sole managing conservator, even though he had no pleadings to support it. He did not ask for it. The mother complained the trial court abused his discretion because he did not plead for that relief at trial. The father claimed that the issue was tried by consent, and this court reversed, following also a Houston 14th District Court case decided the year earlier, Balser versus Medina. In both of those cases, when you have, basically, as I said, they're kind of right on point. You're dealing with a situation where no one was trying to get anyone named as the sole managing conservator and the sole possessory conservator. And there are differences. There are subtle and nuanced differences contrary to what Mr. Michel urges in his brief. They deal with perception by the court, perception by the public, and differences in burdens of proof on modifications, whether it's custodial or trying to adjust and work with a visitation schedule. There is, I might have to say, almost a stigma attached to being a sole possessory conservator as opposed to being a joint managing conservator who does not have the right of the superior right of possession. In any event, the court held, both of those courts held in cases almost exactly like this, that where the record was devoid of pleadings and evidence indicating that the parties understood that the issue was before the court, the issue could not have been tried by consent. Neither the pleadings nor the proof in this case indicated that the designation of conservators as far as sole versus joint was at issue. If the court wants to adopt, basically what Mr. Michel wants this court to do is to say, well, if you mention a child in your pleadings, then it's basically a judicial free-for-all. You can name everybody whatever you want. You can do whatever you want. You can change the designations. You can change all sorts of things. And that's just not how we try cases in this state. And that's, notice is important.
What's your response to the appellee's argument that this should have been objected to at the time of the entry of judgment and it wasn't?
The cases are different because the court's already made its decision. The court has made its decision. In the other cases where you're supposed to make an objection to the pleadings not conforming or where they're getting relief outside what they ask for, those usually are jury cases. You know, and it's...
Give me an example, counsel, to help me understand.
The example actually can be seen in one of the cases cited by Mr. Michel. You have a jury. You're supposed to make your objections to the charge. There was a case cited by him where there was an award of treble damages. I know the court has read that. In that case, the court held that the objection should have been made during the charge conference. That's when you're supposed to make those objections. When you say they're not entitled to this relief, that's when you make your objection. An issue in that case was submitted regarding the treble damages argument because it dealt with a kind of a complex DTPA interplay with, I don't know if you read it, with the insurance code, I think 2121-16B. About how you're entitled to treble damages when the two work together by listing the laundry list and all that kind of stuff in a DTPA case. And I know I'm just skimming it, but I know all of you know these arguments. Well, in that case, their opportunity to object to that was at the charge conference. And because they didn't do it at the charge conference, the judgment was rendered, and there was the judgment. There was no obligation that I know of that's imposed by the appellate rules or the rules of civil procedure.
Here we don't have a charge conference.
Because you don't have a charge conference.
But weren't you required to raise it perhaps in a motion for new trial?
There's nothing in the rules that say you have to raise such an issue in a motion for new trial. It's just not there. Check that before we file anything. It is just not there. The court's made their decision and that's what happens. And so, you know, the judge knew what the judge was doing in terms of making decisions. The court made its decisions. I don't think that was going to work out on a motion for new trial, nor were we required to. We objected in the motion for new trial to certain things, like sufficiency of evidence. I don't even think we had to have done that in this case, but we did it in an abundance of caution. I believe we could have just gone ahead and filed our appeal if we had wanted to do it in that way without the motion for new trial. Because it was a bench trial. That is exactly right. The judge is presumed to know the law and made her ruling, and that's what she did. So I don't think there's waiver there. I think it makes a very, very big difference between a bench trial and one to a jury. With regard to the evidence, And I'll move on. I think I've talked a little bit about the procedural issue and the fact that we don't think the issue was tried by consent. And it's kind of like in a personal injury case where you have your universe of outcomes. You can maybe zero to $200,000. Well, if a jury comes back at $5 million, but there's no pleadings and really no evidence to support that, you can't award. You're governed by the pleadings and by the evidence. That's what you're governed by. It doesn't turn into a free-for-all where you can just do anything. And that, in essence, is kind of what we had here. I do want to talk a little bit about the evidence that had been presented. There was no evidence that the mother presented that the mother should be removed as the joint managing conservator with a primary right of possession. There just wasn't. None of the experts who testified in the case said that ought to happen. None of the witnesses really said that ought to happen except for the father. And the father also said, but the mother, I support her right to her relationship, and she should have an extended standard visitation schedule. I know the court knows what extended standard visitation schedule is, set out in the family code. You know, there are presumptions that it's in the best interest of the child for both parties to be named as joint managing conservators. There was no evidence here to rebut that presumption. There's a presumption that it's in the best interest of the child for a parent who is the non-primarily custodial parent to have an, at least at the very minimum, a standard visitation schedule. Both of those presumptions are set out in the family code. There was no evidence to rebut that here. I do want to talk a little bit about what was in Mr. Michelle's brief about, he talked about parental alienation syndrome a little bit. There is no such thing. Now, there are adherents of that particular theory that have tried to get that put in the DSM-4 and the DSM-5 for some years, but they have not been able to do it. It is not a thing. There is no such thing as parental alienation syndrome.
But there is such a thing as parental alienation.
There is.
It's a bad thing.
And it is a bad thing.
And there is some evidence in the record of that.
At least we have some findings by Judge Wells.
There are findings by Judge Wells that there are. That is correct. And I believe the record would consider...
There was an alienation between the father and the child. Whether the mother was the cause of it was an issue.
That's
but there
correct.
Was at least some evidence that, yes, some of her actions contributed to that.
I'm not sure that there was that much evidence on that, certainly not the quantum of evidence that one would remove her as the joint managing conservator and name
her. I'm not saying it rises to a particular level, but you had said there's no evidence of it, and there is some evidence that there was some alienation going on.
But most of that alienation interaction was between the father and the child in terms of an estrangement. That's kind of the flip side of alienation.
Right.
It's you got alienation on one side practiced by one parent against the other parent, basically. Then you've got estrangement practiced by the so-called alienated parent with the child. There was a whole lot more evidence in the record of the issue being between the father and the child, to the point where even the father's own family reunification counselor did not advocate even giving him overnight visitation immediately, much less changing the entire visitation schedule to where mom doesn't even have standard anymore. And that was his reunification counselor. None of the experts, assuming we give validity and ascribe any validity in the appointment of numerous experts, counselors, reunification counselors, we had four or five experts in this case, plus two court-appointed individuals serving as guardian ad litem and amicus. The amicus attorney, you know, nobody argued for that. The only thing that anyone argued was that Lori DeAngelis, who was the amicus at the time, who'd been on the case all of 2 months after a three-year procedural history, said, we ought to do something drastic, like give him the rest of the summer. Give Dad the rest of the summer. That's what she said. And lo and behold, what we got out of this was an order that we believe did not comport with the pleadings, did not comport with the evidence, did not comport with the father's own requests. So we believe that the court should find that this court should find the trial court abused its discretion in removing the mother as the joint managing conservator making the father a sole managing conservator, and in awarding the mother a non-standard limited possession schedule. Along the way, since we've also asked that the court set aside the judgment in favor of the father granting attorney's fees and costs against the mother, and we just believe that this case should be reversed and the whole thing sent back to the trial court for a new trial. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. Thank you, and may it please the court. I have not taken a position as what has happened down in the trial court. It was simply in preparing for oral arguments this afternoon. I saw those filings and what was coming up, and I thought it might affect the court in its analysis of what may happen, because I'm not taking any stance, but there is a final setting for a motion to sign a final order set for October 23rd.
Can you clarify something for me?
Yes.
In this case that we're dealing with, this appeal right now, the mother's petition for modification was filed when again?
I
know it's in here.
2012.
Okay, but this order that the judge is poised to sign,
yes,
it's related to a petition for modification filed. Is it the same one or is it a different
time? No, it's a new one.
Both. It's the new one.
Yes.
Okay.
If you recall in the petition for writ of prohibition,
yes.
We were up here saying there was a split of authority between the courts of whether the trial court could even proceed forward with a pending appeal.
And that's why it could become moot.
Correct.
Okay. I understand now.
Absolutely. I would think you would want to know that if you're getting ready to write an opinion. In 30 days, there's a new order.
And I haven't had the opportunity to read the notice that you filed today, but it would be your position based on what you just stated that or at least that we should be aware of that
yes.
The judge's decision could moot this entire case.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you for clarifying that.
It would, and I don't think there will be a dispute. Mr. Kacher may disagree that the judge should not sign that order, but I think if the judge does sign that order, we have a new final order that then moots this order because that order is now gone.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a new appealable order, which I'm sure they will appeal. So,
okay.
And you can see the proposed order, Judge Wells finds even more alienation. So I'm sure that we will see you again should that order get entered.
Okay, well, let me tell you, here's a problem I've got with the case, and so I want you to address this. The amicus attorney said at the end of it, something drastic must be done, okay? And then the trial court did something that could be perhaps fairly characterized as drastic. But there was no evidence in the record that the actual course that the judge took in fashioning this drastic remedy was in the best interest of the child. And so isn't that an abuse of discretion in and of itself if there was nothing to support that? And it's drastic. And there's no evidence that says that that particular drastic course, the only thing we've got is someone saying something drastic needs to be done. And then the trial court does it. But there's no evidence to support what the trial court did. Forget the pleadings and everything else. That's
sure.
A different issue. That's what worries me about this.
Okay. Well, I will tell you, I strongly disagree, Justice Sutterith. Having practiced family law for over 25 years, this is exactly what you do in parental alienation cases. It is like a detox where you have to suspend the contact with the alienating parent.
But see,
yes.
And you may be right.
Yes.
I'd certainly.
Charles is very aware of this. She's
right.
Up on this topic.
No, I would not impugn the knowledge of this trial judge.
Yes.
The question is, though, does the evidence support it?
I clearly think so. I was just going and preparing, and Judge, nobody has to come in and say, as an expert, and say, I think, Judge, I'm going to sit in your position and tell you should do X. That's what the judge does based on the evidence. Now, what we heard, right, is if you confront this child by Dr. Gallagher, she says, okay, my only job with this is try to keep this child happy and going. I'm not supposed to rock the boat. She never challenges. Anybody who challenges the child gets discarded. Lori Spearman, the previous counselor, the reconciliation counselor, Melanie Berman, the father, anybody who tries to address. Don't forget, this case was not.
But who said on the record?
Yes.
And so, because of all this,
yes.
She needs to be removed from the mother for a significant period of time to rehabilitate. Who said that?
Well, Lori DeAngelo said that we need to limit the access to the mother. She said that in her report on the record. Mm-hmm. And don't forget, Judge Wells interviewed the child in chambers. But I don't think anybody has to say that.
Okay.
I don't think anybody has to say that. In fact, that is like an expert on telling on a negligence case. A fact finder can say, I find that person negligent.
So a trial judge can just experiment on children?
I don't think so. Don't forget, Judge Wells had this case for 3 years. She suspended visitation. She supervised visitation. He had to go through a battery of sexual tests, four CPS investigations, mm-hmm. and close to 10 witnesses who have testified about this. The problem with alienation.
Let me finish. I don't question this judge's intelligence or competence to do what she does at all in any way. I'm just saying, at the end of the day, we have to judge the result. And can she just pull it out of her head? Or does there have to be evidence to support that what she's doing is in the best interest of the child? You're saying that she can just draw on experience and that's enough.
No, she is vested with the discretion to set the visitation schedule. And that's what she did here.
And it's unfettered. That is unfettered.
No, it's not unfettered. It's not unfettered. The court, as the reviewing court, is not to second-guess Judge Wells' position as the trier of this case for a period of 3 years, hearing every witness testifying and observing. You don't just...
It seems to me the standard...
Says, nobody comes in and says, I'm alienating.
Right, but it seems to me the standard you're asking us to adopt is just trust the judge. She knows what she's doing. And she may know what she's doing. But I don't think that's the standard.
I don't think it is. I think you have to get the standard that she is vested with the discretion to set the visitation schedule. And in this case, she heard all of the evidence from 10 different witnesses at least, and including counselors and psychologists. But it's the visitation schedule. It's not unfettered. She based it on the experience of saying, as the trial court, remember, the jury doesn't set the visitation schedule. A trial judge sets the visitation schedule based on what that particular judge sees to be appropriate for the best interest of the child. She stated this is one of the hardest cases she's ever had. She's tried everything, and she thinks that the best interest of the child is that she have a relationship with its father. These findings are not challenged on appeal, that there is an alienation going on. That is binding on this court. The trial court found that the father did nothing wrong. That's not challenged on appeal. As a result, the trial court is not just pulling out. If she varies from a standard guideline, Justice Sutterith, what is she relying on? Nobody comes in and testifies. In 90% of our cases, you don't have a psychologist coming thinking, I think this should be the schedule to visitation. What are they basing it on? Well, their interviews with the child and their parents. Judge Wells interviewed the child. Judge Wells heard the testimony of both parents. She heard the recommendation of Lori DeAngelis, who once again, if you're saying it's just pulling it out of her hat, Lori DeAngelis, who testified as the guardian ad litem, that access should be limited to the mother, and exclusive, which is what you do in these cases, is exclusive uninterrupted time with the father. Because there's like the Jim Jones, whatever. When you take them out of a captured area, it's tantamount to brainwashing. You need the time alone where you can't be. And that's why Judge Wells stair-stepped it back into place.
Where's the evidence of that?
Of what?
What you're talking about, the brainwashing, that the appropriate steps that need to be taken when alienation is occurring.
Well, I think that is something that the judge would, Lori DeAngelis, for one, said.
And her saying that there needed to be some separation.
And she also said that access needed to be limited to the mother.
And something drastic needs to be done.
Correct. Based on the evidence. Now, granted, we've cited you the articles on alienation as well and what they recommend about how you try to handle these situations.
Would other evidence be the fact that, or that we can consider the fact that Judge Wells might have considered that there were four CPS investigations of this father and none of those turned out to have any merit?
Absolutely. And the way she responds about putting her head under a blanket and screaming and yelling at the reunification counselor, running out, the mom honking the horn at the end of the session, the daughter going into the bathroom and texting the mother to find out what's going out, finding out that court hearings are canceled, the only source that could come from is from the mother. I mean, this case is legendary for the alienation that's going on. This mother won't quit. And this next round has happened and continued. But just as other, yours is, so what is Judge Wells supposed to look at setting the guidelines? There is no handout. There is no statutory prescribed sentencing guidelines on visitation. That is, we've cited you all the cases. The parameters are the sound discretion of the court, which is perceived to be the best interest of the child. Now, we can't cite you to a standard visitation schedule, because the only thing we have is a presumption of guidelines. Clearly, we've gone way past that with the amount of alienation that went on through 10 different witnesses and the severity of this child's alienation that Judge Wells has reasoned and concluded. If this court tells Judge Wells that her visitation schedule is inappropriate, what guidelines would this court be looking to? That's my question, is I think these are appropriate standards. She gets second and fourth weekends. She gets visitation with the child. She gets it near the center. She had contact with the child. It's not like she cut off access. Heck, I lost a case where I got 2 hours of visitation twice a month. As far as the pleading guidelines, and I know this court may be not as concerned, we cited the cases in Justice Pittman. I've not seen any distinction between a jury trial and a non-jury trial. The court's cases are legions. You've got to object to the defect in the pleadings. In the ABH case, which was my case, which I won here in the court because they didn't plead it, I got hired and I immediately objected when I got the judge's ruling. I preserved it all the way through. The cases are materially different. The mother in that case filed a little motion to modify on daycare provider because the grandparents who were supposed to provide daycare weren't available like 180 days out of the year, so she used up all of vacation trying to scramble these kids. He filed a counter motion. The only evidence in the record was from the social worker that dad should be possessory because he's so alienating, and soul should go to mom. Just Judge Harris flipped that and gave it to dad when there was nothing in the record about anything like alienation or notice. And plus, we've cited the father's proposed parenting plan, which he asked for all the exclusive rights and duties, which is the distinguish. If you track the order between that was signed by Judge Wells and you track his parenting plan, they are identical with what the judge proposed, with the exception of the nomenclature of sole managing conservator and possessory conservator. And when you compare the two in the family code and in the standard forms, possessory and sole and managed conservators are all the same. They get the same 8 joint duties. They get the same 2 duties. It's only the rights and duties at all times, which are those which were delineated and which were specifically requested by the father and which were unobjected to at trial. And I put in the brief, should the court want to modify the nomenclature, well, I'm not saying that the court should, but I mean, if that's the biggest objection, is just the name of possessory versus sole, it's not going to have any meaningful effect on the rights and duties. As we all know, when you do family law, you look under what are the rights and duties to see what it is you actually get to do. As far as the issue about what Judge Wells relied on setting the guidelines, I think she was entitled to listen to this record from all of those witnesses and the extensive unchallenged findings of alienation, that she could set forth a reasonable visitation plan, which I think is reasonable. She's not cut off. She set forth contact with phones, contact at school, visitation over the weekends. Judge Sutterworth, if you're gonna criticize Judge Wells's possession schedule, what, one more weekend? A weekend during the week? That's why we don't try to pick and choose as to what the possession schedule, if she had cut off visitation, if she imposed supervised and no visitation on my client and he went through the hoops based on these found out to be false allegations of these CPS investigations. He went through no visitation. She's never been cut off. She's got all of the rights and duties except for those exclusive ones. And she has a reasonable visitation period, twice a week, summers, holidays. We would request that the court affirm this judgment, and we may be back.
Mr. Michelle, that brings me to more so a comment rather than a question. I have some deep-seated concerns here that the entrance of the letter ruling that Judge Wells made back in June on October the 23rd could very well moot most of the matters currently before the court. Certainly don't like our time to be wasted and ping-pong back and forth.
Correct.
From us to the trial bench. I trust that if we don't have a decision in this matter that comes out before October the 23rd, that we will be notified as soon as possible as to what the court does.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Thank you.
That was my purpose of trying to, when I found out that this was set, and I think it was only set about a week or two ago, when I found out about it, I wanted, that's why I hate doing things the morning of oral argument, but as soon as I found out, I wanted to advise the court because it would, I think it would affect your time and effort on writing an opinion.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Justice Pittman, let me just discuss a little bit, since I have a tad more knowledge than Mr. Michelle does about what's going on. What happened is a temporary order. That's all that's being decided down there. And quite frankly, I think Judge Wells forgot. We had a writ of prohibition. We were in the middle of temporary orders hearing, and that's why I brought up all those temporary orders hearing notices to the court in response to the thing that Mr. Michelle filed this morning.
Are you drawing a distinction between temporary orders and a petition to modify?
That's correct.
Okay. So you're saying this is on temporary orders?
All that is on temporary orders.
Okay.
And because it dragged out because of the writ of prohibition that was filed, and we had to have hearings on that, and then we had to reschedule with experts and everybody, by the time we got around to finishing it, the temporary orders hearing lasted basically different parts of about 4 to 6 days. And we didn't finish it until June, but it was just a temporary orders hearing. And it's a little disingenuous, I think, to be arguing, well, this is going to be a file that's going to moot this court's, what this court is doing. That's absolutely not correct.
Yeah.
I've already paid a jury fee, and we actually have a tentative setting for July of next year for a final in this.
For the petition to modify.
For the petition to modify.
Okay.
And, you know, I've had some discussions with Mr. Schmidt about it, and I don't want to go into those, but this was a temporary hearing, and it's supposed to be a temporary order. I think the judge just forgot because it dragged on so long. But that's all that it ever was.
It will be clarified, I'm sure, in the order if it's signed.
On October 23rd, I anticipate that we will have it'll be called a temporary order. Let me just talk a little bit about what Mr. Michelle said about he's been practicing law and doing family law 25 years. I'm on my 38th. In fact, Judge Wells and I were admitted to the bar. At the same time, which is something we chuckle over, the fact we're still doing this when maybe we should be doing something else. But in any event, the problem is with so-called parental alienation, that's why it's not recognized as a syndrome. And there is no quote-unquote blueprint here on what to do. Nobody says, and that may be one of the reasons why it's not recognized, because psychologists don't know how to fix it yet. There are some ideas. None of them, however, since we're arguing about what parental alienation is and isn't, none of them say you basically limit mom's access. The idea is to rehabilitate the relationship between the alienated parent and the child. And that should be the focus. And some sort of punishment, which we have in this case, is not appropriate. There's nothing that supports that in the science of psychology, which unfortunately I've had to read more than I cared to read about it. There's nothing whatsoever that supports what happened here. Justice Pittman, you mentioned the CPS reports. I don't think there's any evidence in the record to reflect who filed the CPS reports. I don't think that they were ascribed to the mother.
Would it matter? Tell me why that's a salient point.
Well, the court mentioned that as some grounds, I suppose, to support the judgment of the court that alienation had taken place. I thought the court...
And I just leave that out as an example.
Okay. Had the mother filed for CPS reports that were ruled unable to determine or unfounded, then I might agree with the court. But I don't think there's any evidence in this record that says that the mother filed those complaints. There is evidence in the record in terms of the relationship between the child during therapy that the father of the child was confrontational. It was his way or the highway. And that didn't necessarily play well with the child. There was evidence in the record that the therapist were helping the child get her own voice. And so the child voices her opinions of the father. And now, as a result of that, somehow, oh, it's the mother's fault, she must have alienated her, because she tells her father what she thinks about him and about these situations. You know, adolescence is a very difficult time. Prepubescent children, it is not easy. And I don't think that the remedy for resolving a problem between a father and the child is in the best interest of the child to basically extremely limit the mother's relationship with the child, when, as the record reflects, the mother has done an outstanding job of raising that child as a joint managing conservator with a primary right of possession. The child was doing well in school. The child's flourishing. This is not the right remedy to fashion. So we're requesting that the court reverse the judgment of the trial judge and remand this case for a new trial.
Thank
and
you.
I think that's all I have.
Okay. Gentlemen, your case has been submitted, and you are now free to go about your business.